Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Nicholas. It's actually a pleasure for once to be chatting to two other members of the group who are also now in Cape Town. So we're all Cape Townians.
Indeed, this is
enjoying
a weird...
the same sunny weather, I hope. I know we're quite distant. Quite distantly located across the peninsula, but yeah, nice to see you both.
Indeed, it is a weirdly Cape Town centric cast we have today, and we're also joined today by Anlu Kieva, who is having some internet issues. She is on a particular wireless provider who shall go unnamed, but that's causing her some internet issues. So if there's a little bit of a pause between when I say something to her and when she replies, it's just because of that. But anyway, Anlu, very happy to have you on the show today and welcome.
Thank you, Nicholas. I'll be keeping it short and sweet to make sure that there's no talking over each other, but I'm doing well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, let's talk about our first story. And this is, you know, on one hand, I'm actually tired of talking about just all of these endless stories about municipal malpractice and bad governance, particularly the Gauteng water crisis, which is continuing to bubble away. I don't know if that's a play on words, but anyway, continuing to bubble away in the background. Unfortunately, if we stop talking about it, it's really not going to make it go away. It's still there. It's still messing with people's lives. It's still causing significant problems. And so, in fact, Anlu this morning put out a press release on this issue, just talking about the problems with the Gauteng water system, and that there are now, it seems, some signs that the municipalities and the government is reacting to the crisis. Anlu, do you maybe just want to run us a little bit through the basic ideas of what you said here?
Yes, of course. So perhaps just to give a little bit of insight into how I feel when I start listening to the minister now, I get a sense of frustration inside myself every time I listen to her, because it feels to me like she's blame shifting. And although she shifts some of the blame to municipalities, it feels like she's shifting a lot of it onto consumers. And specifically in the press release, an important point for me was to get across the idea that instead of her actually every time shifting the blame and making excuses for why we're in the crisis that we are, I mean, if you consider what she said only in the past week, sometimes it's the municipalities who fail, yes, which is the case. But then other times it's the residents. They either haven't harvested enough rainwater or for some reason washed their cups in drinking water, which is apparently a major issue. And if all else fails, then we sit and blame the heat wave. And I mean, summer comes every year and we know that Gauteng is, it water needs to be pumped to it. So this is a recurring issue and we have it regularly, and it's not the first time that we're in the situation that we are. So instead of her blame shifting, I think it's honestly time to put more pressure on her and to, as you said, it's a recurring issue and we're getting tired of it, but it's so important to continue pressuring her and obviously all the municipalities and the other officials, but to put specific pressure on her to acknowledge, listen, okay, I understand that we need to, instead of gaslighting residents and SEN, and instead of putting pressure on residents to, from their side, decrease supply, we should start getting the 48% that's going missing back into the pipes and get it to the residents. And for her to actually acknowledge, listen, okay, I know that, obviously she won't say this, but I think it's important that a department is only as strong as the leader at its helm. So I think that was the gist of it. And that's what we think is at least the important part of it.
You know, when you get any big crisis like this, it's kind of, there's sort of many layers to it, right? There are failures at the municipal level, particularly in a municipality like Johannesburg, where there's just this huge amount of leakage and wastage of water, and just not an efficient maintenance plan or infrastructure development plan to kind of sort that out. You've also got the fact that there's these arguments about whether the province is doing all of the things it needs to be doing and Randwater to sort that out. But from what I've heard, Randwater is, of all the parties involved in the Gauteng problems, one of the least to blame. And then you've got the national government, who have failed to properly deliver the Lesotho Highlands Water Project on time, which means that they're sort of at the other end of the pipeline, so you know, where the water is coming from, that not enough is being supplied. And then on the ground, you've also got this issue of people not paying for services. And this is something that was highlighted by the Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs Minister, IFP leader Vilenkosini Hlapisa, who was saying in Parliament when answering questions that the country really needs to stop its culture of non-payment. He was talking generally about municipalities and having difficulty paying their bills. He said, quote, "If you want municipalities to be functional and to be able to pay what is due to Eskom, due to water boards, business people must pay municipalities. Municipalities must firstly conclude indigent registers so that all of us who are working pay for services we receive from municipalities. In order to address the problem of water boards and Eskom, we need to do it in a comprehensive approach. All departments should pay what is due to the municipalities." He said that government departments currently are owed about 29.4 billion rand. And what's amazing about the culture of non-payment is just how prevalent it is kind of all over the place. You've got people who are not indigent but should be paying their bills, who are not paying their bills for electricity and water. You've got middle-class people who are sometimes bypassing meters in order to get access to free services. You've got businesses that sometimes will play fast and loose with paying their municipal bills. You've got government departments and politicians and ministers and just all over the system from the top to the bottom, there are people who are not paying their bills. And when that happens, you've got an issue where just kind of everything becomes dysfunctional. Yes, the services delivered by municipalities is often of very low standard. But at the same time, people are often not paying for the services that they're owed. Now, it's not true for there's a very solid group of South Africans who do pay their bills and are kind of keeping the whole thing running. But when you just have such negligence and dysfunction throughout the whole system, it kind of makes it impossible to fix because, you know, do you start at the bottom and try to get people to pay? Well, why do people want to pay if they feel like they're being ripped off by their municipalities? You try to get municipalities to kind of fix it from the top, improve their services so that people are more willing to pay. Well, then municipalities don't have the money to do it because people aren't paying. It's kind of a bit of a nightmare here. Michael, what's your thoughts on this issue?
What you're describing there is something, if I'm not mistaken, Andrew, that you described in your report of the release on the 1st of November, Gauteng's water crisis. I think it was there that I read this phrase being applied to as being a vicious circle. That, you know, one thing is a problem. It's a legitimate problem. It ought to be tackled. But it leads to another, which is also a legitimate problem, needs to be tackled, which leads to the third one. And you get this compounding sequence of events which defy solution. I'm just thinking of that phrase that Anlu used about, you know, a department is really only good as the person at its helm. I think this is very, very important. It must begin with, as we were chatting, Nicholas, on Wednesday, with the people getting the sense that they are being addressed by accountable, responsible politicians who are, in fact, interested in responding to what is happening to them. And I think, you know, the virtue of a government appeal, and I completely agree with you that I think Shabisa's point is absolutely right, that it's not tenable for South Africa to just continue along a path of, ignoring due payment and so on. But the virtue of a government appeal is actually secondary to the fact that the authority of that appeal is proportionate to the credibility of the government itself. And this does come back to Andrew's point about the credibility of the leadership. There's just two things that I thought, you know, just to bear this out, that are worth highlighting in Andrew's press release this morning. She points out that the challenge is not the logistics, that everybody knows that Gauteng is an inland province. and requires water to be pumped to municipalities and all the rest. It's not, this is not a problem of logistics. And in her words, it's the ongoing failure of those in charge to make sure that the system works, fixing leaks, stopping illegal connections quickly, and keeping up with regular maintenance. So that's the sort of abstract umbrella sort of expression of the problem. But if we look at elsewhere in her release, there's some detail, which is just quite shocking, where she points out that 48%, or roughly 2.5 billion litres of Gauteng's water supply is lost daily. This is every day. Is lost to leaks, theft, and dilapidated infrastructure. So that's, you know, I often think of one of the easiest ways to, we're talking to kids and so on, to express the idea of how many liters, you know, what how many liters looks like. 2.5 billion liters. You imagine 2.5 billion bottles of Coca-Cola. I mean, it's, you know, it's just a stack. It's a staggering heap of staggering quantity. And this is a daily loss. This is a daily loss to exactly the things that Andrew has described. And which really does pinpoint what the problem is. And one hears, I think it's important, you know, that you have ministers saying, you know, pointing out that we do actually need to deal with this. Minister Shlabisa is quite correct in that regard. The figures also, I mean, they're quite staggering. The amounts being owed by various people, but the fact that it's, as you say, Nicholas, right across all the strata of government and society. It's everybody has got onto this kind of bandwagon. And I suppose it's also partly a consequence of a society in which so many things that happen, so many crimes that get committed, so much fraud that goes on, is never punished. Is there never any consequences for doing the wrong thing? That, you know, eventually the one compounds the other, and it becomes a very great problem. But a good place to start, I think, would be at the ministerial level. The minister taking responsibility, saying, this is what we're to blame for this. We're going to do this about it. And that's, I think that would be a good start.
Yeah. I think fundamentally, what in many ways what's being described here is that South Africa is in many ways a low-trust society.
Yeah.
There's this feature of human beings in our psychology that we're willing to give people leeway and to put up with things and to deal with issues unless we feel like a sucker. And the moment people stop feeling like suckers, they start to get off of the responsible bandwagon and they start to engage also in negative behaviors. And I think you're right, Michael, you know, fixing, starting at the top is, I think in many ways, an important thing that would definitely cause people to maybe follow an example and realize that things are in fact changing and that there is someone who is doing their job. Because when you have people at the top who are just, you know, not providing a great example, sort of everyone else down the chain of command maybe will think to themselves, well, why should I bother? Am I just being a fool here for following the rules in this dog-eat-dog society? Okay. Anlu, any final thoughts from you before we move on?
Yes. I listened to, I think it was earlier this week, Michael, that you were on the podcast and you specifically spoke about the water problem. And, I should say crisis, but, and I particularly liked what you said about the way that you approach it. And in Cape Town, it was a joint, we are all working together, we will get through this, we will fix it. And although the circumstances of the crisis was different, I think the approach is an important lesson that we need to learn from. And I don't see that being applied here. What I see here, and you'll probably get, whoever's listening to this will get bored of me saying it, but it's very frustrating. And I think for that reason, I want to emphasize it over and over. The fact that she is not saying it's a joint, we all need to. Although she says it, it's the sense with which she says it. She is giving me, the reader, a sense that I am doing wrong by using water. And I am not doing wrong by using water, especially not if I'm paying for it. And I think that's an important thing that needs to be pointed out more.
Yeah, I think very good point.
Right. Exactly. Okay, let us move on to our next story. And this is based off of reporting from the Daily Maverick, which has looked into what's been going on at the South African Human Rights Commission. This is an organization that we have at times thought did good things, but also definitely had very different views from us being the Institute of Race Relations. It's a Chapter 9 institution established by the Constitution to try and sort of provide an avenue for people to complain about abuses of human rights. And I think that almost everyone has probably got at least one judgment from the South African Human Rights Commission that they think was really not a great judgment. But anyway, this report from the Daily Maverick suggests that all is not well within the organization. And the story starts here by talking about the South African Human Rights Commission's report, which has taken 2 years, into the causes of the July 2021 unrest, the July riots, as I usually call them. Now, one of the central points of contention here is the role that Jacob Zuma and his followers have played in this. Indeed, there are quite a few people who refer to this as an insurrection, essentially an attempt to overthrow the government, or at least cause chaos and you know, create a political crisis for the arrest of Jacob Zuma. Personally, I think that that may definitely have been the spark, but that this was in many ways a more complicated issue. This has come up in the report itself, where apparently the first draft was a draft which claimed that Jacob Zuma was definitely, or at least his arrest definitely did play a role in this, and that there was an enormous amount of testimony given where various people said that they were going to basically start riots if Jacob Zuma was arrested. One of the submissions was from former Gauteng Premier David Makura, who told the panel of the South African Human Rights Commission he had met with police bosses before the unrest to share information he'd received about, quote, meetings taking place to discuss resistance should President Zuma be incarcerated. Civil society organizations told the panel that the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma had triggered the events of July 2021, but the conditions of desperation led to many poverty-stricken people being caught up in events. I think that's pretty much my view. And yet, the commissioner appears to have removed, Chris Neeson, appears to have removed this link to Zuma from the report. Zuma appears 112 times in the report, but Neeson, apparently in the final draft, took that out. He, responding to the Daily Maverick, said that he had prevented the commission from finding that Zuma's incarceration was the trigger. Neeson said, quote, "The public's trust and faith of us is important to the South African Human Rights Commission. This is why I resisted attempts to pressure us to blame Jacob Zuma for the July 2021 civil unrest in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. We will not be bullied into making incorrect scapegoating findings." He, however, said that the original report had not been edited. This has also kind of surfaced a whole bunch of allegations from people who work for the South African Human Rights Commission, who were all unwilling to go on the record, which is always a bit frustrating, claiming that they would be retaliated against due to the toxic environment that apparently is present there, in enormous amount of infighting. Apparently, at one point, Chris Neeson had said that he told internal and external stakeholders that he was, quote, deployed by Lituli House to chair this place, and that he was basically enacting the will of the ANC at the organization. He denied these accusations, saying that his connection to the ANC did not make him impartial when it came to the affairs of the commission. Michael, there's a lot of other details in this story, so people should go and check it out on the Daily Maverick. But what do you make of this? I mean, you know, this is an institution. I have some sort of broader philosophical questions about whether the South African Human Rights Commission should actually be an institution in our system. But it is one, and as long as we have it, it needs to function correctly. And it really doesn't seem like all is well there. What do you make of this story?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. A few things, a few sort of general comments. The first one that strikes me, I think, is that this is, I think, quite a significant story. Partly where it has been published, Daily Maverick, that it's quite detailed. It's quite a bracing read, if you like. It seems to be a kind of no holds barred look at exactly what's going on. Some of those other issues you hinted at a moment ago. There's political bias, even racism. So there's a lot to look at in this piece, and I think it seems to me to partly reflect what I sense is quite a subtle but important sea change in, to use a terrible word, and I'll wash my mouth out with soap a bit later, a sea change in the discourse about South Africa, the kind of discourse about what's true and what really matters in South Africa. And to come back to your point about whether we really need a Human Rights Commission, perhaps central to that sea change is the gathering idea, perhaps, in people's minds, certainly in our sense of things as at the IRR, this gathering sense that 30 years down the line, if you really want to look at a human rights crisis or human rights problems, what you really want to look at is poverty and what is sustaining that poverty, and rather than all the kinds of pit issues which we're constantly seeing being brought forward by race hustlers, race entrepreneurs, the wealthy elite, mostly wealthy elite, much of the establishment, who are invested in a particular kind of narrative. And I think that this counter narrative that I'm referring to, let's have a look at what really is the human rights crisis in South Africa, and it's clearly not to do with the kinds of things that the Human Rights Commission has tended to be obsessed by. It's really to do with things like, you know, why are so many people so poor? Why is there so much malnutrition? What are the policies that are creating all this stuff? Really, really important questions, and these are not being addressed. And I think this idea of trying to separate out an event that cost a lot of lives, for a start, it damaged the economy to the tune of billions and billions of rands, and really did great harm to South Africa's economy and South Africa's sort of reputation in the world. To try and suggest that this had nothing whatever to do with one of the key players in our politics, I think it was simply disingenuous. You know, the actual wording in the report, the commission finds that while the timing of the events of the July unrest coincided with the incarceration of Jacob Zuma, it could not find evidence to link the two events. I think that is just completely bizarre. It's not as if they're saying... We cannot find evidence to say that the one led to the other. They say we can't find evidence to link the two. Well, there's plenty of evidence. I think the tweets that came out of the Zuma camp were very, very explicit and specific to exactly what they were intending there and hoping their supporters would actually get up to. So it's quite an extraordinary thing, but I think a very important moment in our discussion about the kind of society we are, the kinds of things we think are important, and the kind of institutions we want, and the veracity, the authenticity of their work, the authority of their work must reside in their being able to look at things as they really are and not to be swayed by their political loyalties. So yeah, I think all around a very significant story.
Anlu, I think one of the things, of course, it piques my interest in this one is, you know, before state capture came to mean the control of the state by the sort of Zuma Gupta cartel, and all of the corruption that went along with that. I remember Helen Ziller writing a piece in sort of, I think it was the early 2010s, 2012, somewhere around there, talking about the ANC committing state capture, that is, through its program of CADA deployment, bending state institutions which are supposed to be neutral to the will of one particular political party. And I've always thought that was a much better use of the phrase state capture than how it was used in the Gupta thing, which was just, unfortunately, plain old, nasty, scummy corruption. And not, you know, I don't think it needed a new term for it. But this case really does feel a little bit like exactly, I think, one of the problems of when you have a policy of deploying so-called cadres into every single institution in the country here is that people start to ask questions. Well, you know, is this supposedly neutral organization just a tool of one political party in the country? What do you make of this story?
Nicholas, and I'm only saying this to emphasize the fact that I'm in total agreement with you. While Michael was speaking, I made a small note on my notepad here and said, the golden thread is having your hand in the talent pool. And so perhaps just before I go into that, I would have appreciated, I think, just clarifying what a Chapter 9 institution is. It's, say, for example, the Public Protector, the Auditor General, and it's these bodies that are supposed to protect our democracy. And they are the ones that's responsible for fighting corruption, protecting our rights, our human rights, and holding politicians and officials accountable. And it is this kind of reporting and, I should say, so politically influenced reporting, but also even the potential of it being politically influenced, that makes the public lose trust in our institutions. And the moment that happens, officials and politicians act more freely in the sense that they feel there is a lot less that can help, can actually hold them accountable. And they act with the fear of consequences, it's absent. And this then actually contributes to the whole culture of impunity in that sense. And yeah, so the problem here is, as you said, the golden thread is that the moment you start putting your hand in the basket of talent, and you don't just blindly pick whoever is the best candidate, the result of that is mistrust in who is appointed. That is exactly the problem. And then I'd like to kind of draw attention to one of the other things that was in that article that you referred to. And it was that one of the grievances said that Ntuli had the approach was that racism can be fixed with racism and sexism can be fixed with sexism. And this is a very serious problem. I'm not even having a little giggle about it because it's not serious. I'm having a giggle because it's so, it's just... It's mad. Shouldn't even be surprised. It's mad, yeah. And I think it's exactly so. While other politicians say this is the agenda, but they push it at a much more subtly. And this is just a very direct way of saying it. So yeah, I'm not even surprised. I just wanted to draw attention to it because it's as you said, mad.
Michael, any final thoughts?
I'm really glad that you drew attention to that line, Andrea. I thought, I mean, how Orwellian can you be? And you know, with that kind of line of reasoning, with one person who I always, funnily enough, think about is somebody from the left, really, a former Robben Islander, Neville Alexander, but who was very courageous and very astute in contesting this idea. Through the 1990s at UCT and elsewhere, that you could use apartheid categories and then very notion of racism and race to counter the effects of it. And it's obviously, it's a standard principle of liberalism. And we all know that it just leads to tears before bedtime and no solutions. It actually just perpetuates and recreates the very thing that you intend to address, but I'm very glad you raised that, and how revealing, you know, somebody, a commissioner on the Human Rights Commission, who's can actually think like that.
Yeah, indeed, doesn't really sound like it's totally in line with the idea of human rights. There, I must say. Okay, I think we're going to call it there. We had one more story sort of in the pipe, but I think we'll leave it for today. Yeah, I hope that everyone found today's show interesting. I hope that we will see you again on Monday for the Daily Friend Show. And I hope most especially that everyone has a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone, and have a great time. See ya.